tonight on Arena. Pulitzer Prize winning poet Paul Muldoon on his new collection Joy in Service on Rue to Gore, and RTÉ Folk Award winning Glána Hóige perform live in studio. Five one double 51 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTÉ Arena. And with me in studio to start off this week is Pulitzer Prize winning poet, confidant of musical greats from Paul McCartney to Paul Simon, and a musician himself with his band Rogue Oliphant. He's also the master of ceremonies at his own art picnic. Here's the hint, Muldoon's Picnic, which is currently in tour. Who else could I be talking about other than Paul Muldoon? Paul is, of course, first and fundamentally a poet, and his new collection is called Joy in Service on Rue to Gore. In he brings us poems about the last wolves in Ulster. He brings us to Imperial Rome and its connection to glam rock, believe it or not, and back to his native Northern Ireland and the Belfast pogrom. We've spoken in the past, that's quite a journey that you bring us in, and that's only a few of the locations and time spans that we get to, Paul.
Yes, I mean, I do move around. I suppose the mind moves around. Well, first of all, it's great to be here. Thank you so much for having me. Yeah, I mean, there's no control over the poems. I go where they take me. You know, that's the big contract. I try to be true to them, to not to say to them, guys, you know, we shouldn't be doing that. That's not the right thing to do. I try to be at their service. I try to be open to whatever they might get up to. And so that's the bottom line, basically.
It's a kind of, you get out of the way and let the poems get on with it.
Do you know something? That is a critical phrase, and it's a phrase I find myself thinking about, if not using indeed, getting out of the way. Because the big problem with this kind of activity, and I'm sure it's true of many others, it's possibly true of broadcasting, you know, is not, as you say, not to get in the way. Because one doesn't want to, I'm trying to think of a polite way of putting this, one doesn't want to mess it up, you know?
Yes.
And, you know, the problem is that we are, because we're just regular people, we're ordinary people, there's a strong chance that we will mess it up, you know? And so that is, I'm fearful, actually, as I embark on a poem often, thinking, you know, I really, let's hope that we that this comes out and it's going to be half okay.
I don't know if it was the last time we spoke, but certainly we spoke around the time of the whole undertaking of Paul McCartney and the lyrics in, was it in 1956 to the present? We didn't speak about it in 1956. But I'm wondering, you know, do you see that getting out of the way phrase that has kind of jumped into our, given, come to us at the beginning of this interview this evening? Is it the same for the songwriter and the poet, or do you see them as very different? Are they, as time goes on, are they closer to each other or further apart?
You know, I don't know enough about either of them to perhaps...
You've written a few poems now, in fairness.
I've tried to write a few poems. I've tried to write a few songs. Honest to God, that's as much as I ever say. But let's stick with Paul McCartney there, who definitely has written a few songs. And one of the things I really, really enjoyed hearing again and again from Paul McCartney was his absolute belief, his commitment to the idea, first of all, that he has no idea of what he's doing. You know, he actually sat, I used to run a song, a class at Princeton called How to Write a Song, and during the COVID era, we always had special guests, and during the COVID era, we had a very special guest in the shape of Paul McCartney, you know, who showed up on Zoom and, you know, discussed the songs that had been written that week by the 30 or 40 students in the class. So for that, I mean, I say to my students, the key here is you don't know what you're doing. And of course they look at me and they say, well, right, sure. But when somebody like Paul McCartney says it, as he does, I mean, they kind of sort of have to pay attention to that. And what he means by that, of course, is, it's a version of not getting in the way.
Yeah.
You trust that it will do what it needs to do. Now, that doesn't mean that you're lying there kind of as an inert lump. It doesn't mean that at all. But the idea of giving oneself over to the unconscious, the subconscious, is the key to this. And then negotiating with you've got to have some consciousness too. Mm. But it's the unconscious where the most interesting things come from.
Yeah, and I suppose it's being able to tap into that and knowing which bits to use and which bits that are not ready for use. There's a whole bundle of stuff, I suppose, we could talk about in that regard. But I'm wondering, we've mentioned Paul McCartney there. I hesitate to mention Taylor Swift in the same breath, but we had albums on Friday night last. Pillow Queens, local Irish band. Don't know if you know Pillow Queens.
I do know them actually.
And
yes,
Yvan Boland's Name Your Sorrow. They've used that the poem Atlantis, a lost sonnet, very much as the starting point and as a key into their work on that recent album.
Yeah.
And of course, the Tortured Poet Department, an anthology from Tete, I presume you've been listening to all the time on your Spotify.
Believe it or not, I have been listening to it.
Yeah.
Absolutely, because another organ, the Guardian, the English newspaper, asked me if I'd comment on on the tortured poems. They're quite interesting, and she's a phenomenon, and in my own view, and the view of many, I think, poetry is a very broad church, and the more willing you are to accept that, the happier you're going to be, I think, in life. So I really hesitate from saying, you know what, that doesn't belong here.
Or you don't have a right to go near that.
Totally. Yeah. I think that's a mistake. It's a really, it's much better all round for everybody if you say, you know what, Taylor Swift is a phenomenon. I mean, what are we going to start saying? She's not?
Yeah. Yeah, I think you might have, you'd be a very sticky wicket trying to argue that
totally.
Particular. Let us listen to a poem from the new collection. This one, I'm actually going to start not where I said to you a minute ago. Can we start with The River is a Wave? Because there's something about the immediacy and the simplicity of this that really struck me.
That's so nice of you to say that. Because one does want the poem to go back and read it again, perhaps. Mm. But certainly part of it's what it is trying to do. It's a bit like a radio program. You want it to have some sort of immediate impact. Now, what's interesting, I might mention just for our listeners, that this poem is written in a very particular form. It's called a quatern, and it's a form I came across just in the last couple of years, and now I'm kind of obsessed by it. And the great thing about it, the interesting thing about it, is that line one in verse one or stanza one appears as line two in stanza two, and line three in stanza three, and line four in stanza four. And, most people who go into the poetry business, as I'm sure you know, are just bone idle, actually, by nature. I'm certainly one of them. And the fact that you can reuse this line again and again.
I've got a line written for the next set of stanzas immediately.
Absolutely. But, what's fascinating about these forms, and there are so many poetic forms, and of course that's connected to music, that do use repetition. But each time we meet it, it means something slightly different. And that is really an extraordinary. I find that really quite striking, to tell you the truth. The river is a wave. The river is a wave that never breaks, though it may briefly surge as it edges its way out of that 3-mile-long lake in which it's managed to submerge its ever so slightly diminished sense of hurt. The river is a wave that never breaks, despite such fitful spurts of enthusiasm. Let's say, for argument's sake, that if it follows in its own wake to satisfy an imperfectly remembered urge, the river is a wave that never breaks, but is forever on the verge of confronting an issue it's inclined to skirt, since it's only the sea, with its incomparable ache, that may categorically assert the river is a wave that never breaks.
The River is a Wave from Paul Muldoon from his new collection, Joy and Service on Rue to Gore. And there must be a wonderful sense of achievement, relief, all sorts of things when you come to that final line in the fourth stanza going, it's written. That line is written. And it just, it either slots in or it doesn't. And if it doesn't slot in, then you have to go back and make sure it slots in.
Well, again, the key, if I may go back to it that you touched on earlier on, the key is, If you give it its head, if you give it, and it is nervous making, because you're handing yourself over to something, and you don't know what's going to happen. Now, having said that, this is a poem we're talking about. You know, just suppose it doesn't work out. Is that the end of the world? No, it's not. So in some sense, the stakes are not high, right? But the chances of something interesting might happen are real. And, as I say, it's about trust.
Yeah.
That's what I try to do. I try to trust it.
The stakes are a little bit higher in the poem Near Isium. It's a set of poems, really, isn't it? It's a cycle of poems. What have we got? It's nine sections in it. This is for Andrei Kurkov, the Ukrainian novelist and writer. Are you speaking? Are you giving voice to him here, or are you speaking through him? What would you say you're doing in this poem? Because it's quite strong politically.
Yes, it is, and stronger than I suppose. As a citizen, I suppose, for better or worse, every week brings its major issue, which is not to say, by the way, that every week means that one needs to make a statement on every issue. However, there was something about Putin's incursion into Ukraine. I mean, the first thing I thought, and this is really crazy, actually, the first thing I thought as a 72-year-old man was, I should actually go over there. What would W.H. Auden do at a time like this? Well, the smart thing is not to go over there because, but that was my impulse.
To possibly fight? Is that even what you were thinking, to be a member of the forces? Were you thinking that directly?
It's madness, of course. But I think what it represents, and of course there are many contenders for, the most serious danger in which we might be placed, But this seems to be a very, very serious scenario and one that, could easily spiral absolutely out of control if it hasn't already. So anyway, I felt I would write. I mean, poems, as I was saying earlier on, come in all sorts of different forms. Most of my poems are not so, what would one say, saber-rattling or flag-waving.
That's really what struck me about it. I mean, it's on the nose, if I may use that phrase, in terms of what you're saying. I mean, at one point along the way, you say Putin, the name, and is this a translation, or you might explain it a bit to me, that the name itself means path as well as psychopath. Did I read that correctly?
Well, path is what it means, yeah. But, I think there are times when, the form that a poem might take may vary. It's not necessarily going to be your little lovely little musing upon some phenomenon in the natural world, you know.
Because the river and the wave in many ways, the river as a wave is kind of a nature poem in many ways.
Totally, it is. That's absolutely right. So, but I think one, if one's demi-semi alive in the world and trying to make sense of the world and oneself in the world, which is what poets try to do, among others, then, you know, that how that will present itself, how that will show itself, will probably vary from day to day and poem to poem.
And it gave you this sequence of nine, which I'm sure was not a day's work. It must have been a few months' work, I would hazard to guess.
Yeah, I wrote it quite quickly, actually, because like many a poem like that, they're written in a kind of white heat, you know.
There is anger in it. You can sense that. Let me bring you to perhaps a less contentious place, certainly maybe closer to the place where the stakes aren't quite as high, although we might argue that they're pretty high here as well. I'm going to go to Stanley Kubrick's Spartacus, and I'm going to give you a clip here featuring Laurence Olivier as Crassus being bathed by his slave Antonius, played by Tony Curtis.
Do you eat oysters?
When I have them, master.
Do you eat snails?
No, master.
Do you consider the eating of oysters to be moral and the eating of snails to be immoral?
No, master.
Of course not. It is all a matter of taste, isn't it?
Yes, master.
And taste is not the same as appetite, and therefore not a question of morals, is it?
It could be argued so, master.
My robe, Antoninus. My taste includes both snails and oysters.
There we go, Tony Curtis and Laurence Olivier. And people are going, why on earth are they playing Spartacus? And Tony Curtis and Antoninus, in fact, is his name, as Laurence Olivier pronounced it correctly for me there. This all links in, Paul Muldoon, to a sequence at 21. Are they sonnets? I think they are sonnets. 21 sonnet sequence, or certainly a 21 poem sequence. Artichokes and Truffles.
That's right. And it began, the way these things do, with I came across a letter from a guy called Eddie Lewis to Kirk Douglas, which he sent on February 25th, 1959. And they're talking about Spartacus. He says, I have taken one more crack at the censors on the oysters and snail scene in Spartacus. Unfortunately, their objection to this scene is based upon the one remaining stronghold of their department, which is an absolute taboo against portrayal of homosexuality. It is possible, although they will not say for certain, that they would pass the scene if we substituted artichokes and truffles for oysters and snails. So, of course, that was enough provocation
for you to go and do that. So you give us this big sequence of poems called artichokes and truffles. Can we hear sequence five or poem five from that sequence?
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to know if any of it makes sense, even if it in its entirety, but certainly if we cut a bit out of it. Let's see. When Marcus Tullius Cicero was reincarnated as Mark Bolan, it was as if a jeep had indeed dated a Jaguar. There was a time when my old friend Beep was Bolan's publicist and therefore able to reap the benefits of the rock and roll lifestyle. The learning curve is spectacularly steep when you're living in a stately pile. It was, after all, Cicero who categorised the style of Caesar's Gallic Wars as nude. The term file derives from philum, and may well refer to the metallic thread beloved of so many of those chaps who might well be into them old assless chaps. Which, of course, and please forgive us at this time of the night. I mean, we should be waiting till 9 o'clock probably to discuss some of these matters. But the perfect rhyme there on chaps and chaps. I'm a devotee of, among others, the great Lord Byron.
Mm.
And, you know, that's the kind of rhyme. It's the perfect rhyme, of course. You can't do better than chaps. Chaps is the perfect rhyme there. But
you did rhyme in another poem. Moth the Hopple with Aristotle, which to me was the most exciting rhyme in the book from you. Is that a half rhyme? It probably is a half rhyme.
Well, you know, I'm so glad you like that. And, you know, I mean, there's no, as we know, there's no intrinsic merit in rhyme. But I'm one of those old, what would one say, dinosaurs, certainly for many people, who, you know, still believe that there's something... Yeah. There's some fun to be had. There's some discovery to be made through a rhyme. Something that will actually affect how we look at the world might be made through it. You know, for many, the idea of rhyme went out at least 100 years ago, if not longer ago. I myself don't fall into that category, or more accurately, my poems don't.
Yeah.
And they seem to want to, more often than not, come into the world in those traditional forms.
And Mark Bolan arrives there. Did he arrive unannounced, unexpected, and you got out of the way and let him into the poem, or the poem insisted that he was there?
He did. I mean, as it turns out, I mean, I was a huge fan of Mark Bolan when I was a teenager. And, you know, I tried to play Mark Bolan on both. I was influenced also by the Dubliners, and I tried to play Mark Bolan on both the G banjo and the tenor banjo. And the only thing I discovered is that it doesn't quite work. But, you know.
Is this with the Rogue Elephant, yeah?
No, well, it was by myself when I was a child. But I was trying to merge the Dubliners and Tyrannosaurus or T-Rex. But in any case, so, you know, popular culture.
Mm.
Popular culture is a feature in many of my poems. And funnily enough, Mark Bolan's producer, the remarkable Tony Visconti, who's mentioned in the poem, funnily enough, he has just produced... The band that I worked with has just produced our new album, which I had no idea would happen when I wrote this poem. So, you know, it's a strange world.
You talk about the poems almost as if they're a separate entity from you.
Yeah.
Just explain that a bit further to me, because obviously, and I think if I heard you properly earlier on, you were saying it's not as if you're some kind of passive vessel that the poems drive through onto the page. So what is the relationship?
So I am not a passive vessel. I'm not. However, I'm smart enough. I'm not smart, but I'm smart enough to know that the chances of the poem has a better chance of doing something interesting than I do. So I see what it might be trying to do, insofar as I can judge it. And I do feel, I mean, I don't, I say it, again and again, I know people look askance, but it seems to be the case that I don't really write these poems, you know. You know, I by way of example, I'm sure most people, and perhaps I hope a few people listening to this might remember an essay they wrote when they were 15 at school, and they come back and they read it. And they look at it and they think, wow, who wrote that? I don't know if you've had that experience.
Well, yeah, see, there are things like that in one's life, I think, and for several people, yeah.
Exactly. And you look at it and you think, who wrote that? I couldn't have written that. It's too smart for anything I would have ever written. There's something else at work here. There's some other force. And so it's the harnessing of that force or the acceptance of that force which is the business that I'm in.
We'll finish up with a poem, which, because it has to be said, all those things that you're talking about, your love of rhyme and that, when you explain the quatrain term to us with that, the line that moves down the stanza, there's a great sense of fun in that as well. And it's an enjoyment to the ear as well as to the eye when you look at it on the page. This, by the time you read this, is what I want you to finish up with, if you don't mind, on page 66, if you have it there. It kind of struck me as I thought, is this how a Pulitzer Prize winning poet starts to write a note at home to say, I'm just going down to the shop, but it becomes something else? That's what it felt like to me, maybe totally miles away from how the poem happened.
No, not at all. That's certainly the what would one say, the format that it's using. And there are a number of poems that take the form of notes. I mean, one of the most famous ones is William Carlos Williams' poem, This Is Just to Say, which looks as if it might be a poem that's been left on a fridge door. It's the one about, this is just to say I've eaten the, whatever it was, the plums that were in the icebox. You know, they were delicious, so sweet and so cold. So this one is certainly, it is a little bit of a remake of a poem I wrote. It was the title poem of a book that came out in 1980, which was called Why Brownlee Left. And it's a kind of, it certainly has to do with a similar kind of phenomenon of the guy who goes out, not only guys, the people who go out, you know, to buy the Sunday Independent and are never seen again. For whatever reason. So, by the time you read this, I'll be gone for a newspaper and quart of milk, never to return. A half-mowed lawn leading to me as a scroll of silk once led to the mulberry silkworm. By the time you read this, I'll be gone AWOL. In spite of the fact, in terms of domesticity, I've outshone even the heedful trumpeter swan that spends 5 weeks constructing a nest. By the time you read this, I'll be gone, less because of some profound unrest than my fascination with the Cree and the sandhills of Saskatchewan, into which windswept immensity, by the time you read this, I'll be long gone.
There you go. And it's the quatrain again, that form again, with a slight variation in that final line. Paul, thanks so much for being in with us this evening. Thanks for a really interesting conversation.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Paul Muldoon talking to us there about his new collection, Joy and Service on Rue Tagore, which is published by Faber. Blown the Hoige was the title of a 7-part television series on TG Cahir last year, in which 8 young singers from various Gaelic regions were brought together under the musical direction of Sheila Denver and Colm Muchanomara. They arranged and performed a selection of traditional Irish songs for a concert held at the end of the series. One of the songs, Sean Gow, sung with Pearish O'Loughlin, went on to win Best Traditional Folk Track at the RTE Radio 1 Irish Folk Awards this year. The 8 singers will be performing together as Blown the Hoige at the National Concert Hall on May the 3rd as part of tradition. Now delighted to be joined in studio this evening by 3 members of Blown na Hoige, Cathal O'Coroin, and sisters Moira and Eitoin Ní Chóiríne, in studio with me right now. And we're going to start with the song Seolta Gala. Scream and scold, just to feel in one tree.
Ein Schulpaar fahrigen Lang. Kann ich mein Schrein schon nicht gemacht, der Kor ran, nicht bin ich. Ich sehn, Schakarskielt in der Hinschüge vor, es muss ich Schulpaar fahrigen Lang. Slide gar gorgeous and oil card you feed it. It's like a span like a board of a thing. It's what you show no fire farting and on. She had a gain of all the gain. Can you go on? It's like a span. The blood of a thing, smudging shawl of fire, farting and long. Even in sailing, shawl of a ship, sail this evening. Our night and wood, a circulation cheer, smudging shawl of fire, farting and long. She had a gain and what a gain. Ganying and wanting. Our night and wood is our coolish and cheer. Smudging shawl of our farting and numb. She had a gain and what a gain.
Shol the Gala there performed live in studio for us by Cathal O'Carroyne and Sisters Moira and Eitan Níd Chóiríne, members of Blá na Hoige. On Tyrone Shin, introduce that for song first of all. Cover to a Cathal.
Ferman Thorenshin was Mairead Ní Mhaoine, and it was written by her father, Princess Ní Mhaoine. It's about going out to sea, because forgetting about all your worries in the world.
And I noticed as you were singing along there, both Moira and Eitan, I'll go to you in Moira, isn't it? Yes.
Yeah.
I keep mixing up the two. No, I have it in my head now. Moira's in the middle. You were like the sails of the boat sort of rocking alongside it. It has that really lovely, gentle feel to it, doesn't it?
It really does. And I think there's something about Seanos in particular where it's very hard to just sit still when you're listening to it or even when you're singing it. There's just something so natural about just swaying along to the music either way. But especially with Shulty Gal, like for myself and Eitan, anyways at home, like it's just such a bop. Yeah. And like even the way that Cathal sings it, there's just something about it that like, you know, it doesn't matter how tough life is, Shulty Gala will just sail you through. It's just fab.
Yeah,
and stunning.
And listen to the three of you there. You know, you'd swear that you'd been together as a band since the devil was a wee fella. And in fact, I know if all eight members of Blá na Hoige was here, I'd be saying exactly the same thing. Now, it's hardly surprising, Eitan, that yourself and Moira should have that kind of close harmony quality that you do have as sisters. And of course, you were part of Réalta agus Gaelta, Mara Coolamar, Is Réalta Shiv, you are stars, agus Is Gaelta Shiv, your sisters. How important is that family connection for you there? And then how does that expand out into the overall group?
It's so, so important. I will say that being with Maude, singing with Maude, it's so natural, especially when it comes to harmonies, and especially with voices blending. You know, if I was singing a song and if I needed to take a breather, Maura would automatically know. It's just instinct or something. It's amazing. But Blá na Hoige have something special. I think because we also have another family, Seamus and Caoimhe, who are brother and sister. Yeah. And then we also have the link of the Gaeltacht areas, people who've grown
and
up.
You two are from Isos.
So we're from Rockarn. Yeah. Yes, that's Rockarn.
Is that Rockarn Wigina, Agus, Tufin?
Es Cluidor, Mahin.
Yeah, well, the Coolamar and Gaeligan. Yeah. We heard that definitely the Ulster Irish there. But are all of the Gaeltacht areas ultimately represented in the group then, I thought?
Yeah, so we would have Pyrrhus O'Lurcan from Ariel. Agus the Chin, we would have Maveni Vegliach from Gaeltacht Chiri. Yeah. Agus the Chin, Seamus's Caoimhe from Connemara. Agus
Mahenica's Megan Nick Rury from Donegal.
Yeah.
From Donegal, yeah. So there's a real spread across all of that. Yeah, did you have any idea when the television series started out, Moira, that this is what would come of it? You know, this, because it really is a group of eight people now who seem to be this big gig in the concert hall on May the 3rd.
Like, it's so cool that we were able to just come together. It honestly felt like a grown-up summer camp,
yeah,
where we were all brought together and we were like, right, you 4 days to make a CD, and there's, you know, there's cameras rolling all the time. And it was just such a lovely opportunity for all of us to come together to learn from each other. But we also had a project, like we had a goal. We had to record a CD in 4 days.
Well, we didn't know we were recording a CD. It was a TV series with 12 tracks,
It became a CD.
Just madness.
Listen, I could talk to you all night, but we better. I'm gonna have to skip through one of the songs. I want to go to the last song that you had chosen for us, which is Slán Leat, which again brings us into the family connections here. Whose aunt was it that wrote this, Cathal?
So Maeve Ní Bheagla's aunt Eileen escribe to her ansho, and it was to mourn someone who had passed in the family. I think it was her mother.
Yeah.
And it's a lovely fitting call song.
Beautiful sentiment in it as well. You know, Gonairi and Bóthair Leat, that your road may rise before you.
Sinead.
So, Araig Libh, Slán Leat.
Gonairi de Bóthair Leat, Gonairi de Bóthair Leat, Gonairi.
Gonairi and Bóthair Leat, or slán nát mar an tanamatóir an tairán chin. Gramíla magaif, Maira and Eitan ní chairín, agus cahal ó chairán gramíla magaif trúr as vailing anocht. Three of the eight members there of Blá na Hóige performing at the Frank Hart Festival in September, but you don't have to wait that long. They're at Tradition now in the National Concert Hall on Friday the 3rd of May, and you'll get funded information on nch.ie. Gilly Morgan's Birthday Party is a play making its premiere at the Lime Tree Theatre and Belltable Arts Hub in Limerick next week, written by Limerick playwright Liam McCarthy, who was inspired by Anton Chekhov's story The Kiss. It tells a story of love, longing and obsession, centering around the main character Jack and his fixation on Gilly Morgan following a brief passionate kiss at a party in the downstairs toilet. Very attractive at a party in Limerick City in 1983. It's directed by Joan Sheehy, stars Patrick Ryan and Georgina Miller, and it will be on in the Lime Tree Theatre and Belltable Arts Hub in Limerick from the 2nd through to the 11th of May. Delighted to be joined from our Limerick studio this evening by writer Liam McCarthy and actor Georgina Miller.
Hi, Sean.
Liam, how you doing? Georgina, how you doing, Liam? Love, longing and obsession for sure here, but we should be very clear. It might, people would think, oh, well, Georgina must be playing the character of Gilly Morgan. No, Gilly Morgan never actually appears in this play, but boy, does she get spoken about.
Absolutely, absolutely. So the play centres on Jack, as you say, and his experience of a brief moment. And the story starts, where all good stories start, I think, in the downstairs loo at a party in Limerick in 1983. Yeah, and it's kind of a sliding doors between Gilly Morgan and the character Georgina plays, Kate.
Yeah, the character of Kate is very interesting in all of this because it's very difficult. It's her, Georgina, it's Kate and Jack that we meet. We meet them first in 1983, then in 1996, then in 2010, then in 2024, and big life moments along the way. That's quite a task to give us those a character at those different stages of life.
Ah, Sean, with writing this good, it's just so easy. It's so easy to bring them to life.
There's a hundred there for you, Georgina.
Thank you. Yeah, so we meet them at various stages, as you say, and lots happens in between, and it's sliding doors of like, you know, what could have happened if you made a different choice, if you kissed that person that night, or if you, you know, walked out the door 10 minutes earlier or whatever, you could have lived a completely different alternate life. And that's kind of what the play looks at.
Yeah. And as much as anything else, it hopefully tells a story. It's like a social history or the story of a city because, you know, with all jokes aside, the 1980s, while some people think it's a long time ago, it's also very recent past, and the huge social differences between the 80s and 2024 become, you know, a little bit stark when you put them side by side. But what's important for us with this play is, you know, and what I found in the research is, you know, you talk about the 80s, it's, you know, sometimes people refer to it as a bleak time and you think about recessions and immigration, but there was an awful lot or crack. If you think of all like the 80s music, you know, and everyone I've been talking to asking about their memories, their kind of eyes kind of gleam and they start talking about, you know, all the, especially in like Limerick City, there's an amount of the plethora of pubs and clubs and definitely a lot of joy there as well.
Yeah, and I suppose if you look at the various years along the way, 83, 96, 2010, 2024, a song can be enough to trigger us into that particular period in time, Georgina. But for you to actually performing those, I mean, effectively, no matter what way you look at it, she's about, as what, is she in her 30s somewhere
in the
first scene?
Yeah, we start off with her in her 30s, we meet her in her 40s, we meet her in her late 50s. And I was kind of worried that, you know, I'd have to morph and change so much, but actually it just sort of happens organically with where she is in her life that she starts to move a certain way and talk a certain way and... yeah, it's just really interesting dropping in on a life and seeing where it goes to, you know. But it's so much fun to play.
Yeah,
and to play opposite Pat Ryan is just
Yeah, Patrick's playing the character of Jack in the midst of all of this. And, you know, there are shades of One Day, the recent Netflix series,
absolutely,
obviously.
Absolutely.
Very much so. But I
also
think it was,
you're seeing this in the space of an hour and 20 minutes, an hour and a half. It unfolds before you as opposed to, you know,
you don't have to binge,
hours of a binge watch.
Yeah, you don't have to binge watch over an entire weekend.
Exactly.
But you were inspired by an Anton Chekhov story, Liam.
Yeah, absolutely. So there's a famous story, The Kiss, by Chekhov, where it's a soldier, Ryabovich, in 19th century Russia. And for him, he's there at the Grand Russian Estate. And, you know, it's all very, very boring and they're all doing military exercises. But there's this gorgeous moment at the start, I mean, a few pages into the story, where, like, suddenly, for some reason, everyone remembered that it was May and a spring evening and they could smell the leaves and the poplar trees. And your man, Ryabovich, he goes around to this anteroom, and in the dark, there's like this brief, passionate kiss. And in Chekhov's case, it was absolutely mistaken identity, but he becomes very preoccupied with this woman, you know, through the years. You know, I mean, this is not a staging of the kiss, but it's definitely inspired. And, you know, so we're transplanting from 19th century Russia to a downstairs toilet.
Downstairs toilet in Limerick.
Seamlessly.
And Georgina, I mean, Liam touched on it earlier on, but quite definitely, Limerick itself is a huge character within this play.
Absolutely, yeah. So I think, you know, rooting a story in a particular place, it lends this authenticity to it. And whilst I think for a Limerick audience, it'll be so satisfying to come along and recognise the pubs you drank in and the clubs you danced in and whatever, but it's very much a universal story that could be transplanted anywhere. But it's really kind of celebratory of Limerick, which is lovely to see. We don't always get that. And also, as Liam pointed out, the city has changed so dramatically. And I think he does that really beautifully throughout the play that, you know, it's not heavy handed. We get a nod to where we are in the 80s and we see a city grow and develop and change. And it's observed in these tiny little nuanced ways, but says so much within that. So it's a bit of a love letter to Limerick as well, but without it being excluding anyone, I think.
Yeah, no, it is very, having lived in Limerick for a while myself, it mentions parts of the town that were even expanding when I was living there. And you say, wow, yeah, for somebody who'd been there all along to see what was essentially, I think, Jack, rather, the character at one stage talks about Castle Troy, saying, sure, that was a field.
Yeah.
And now it's you know, one of the biggest suburbs.
Yeah. And the university growing up and blossoming and what that brought to the city, and, you know, the endless roadworks that we've been dealing with here for.
Yeah. And I suppose, like, and what we're discovering in the play is that progress isn't a straight line upwards. It's a bit of a loop to loop, you know. So we're seeing, you know, this rapid expansion in the 90s and noughties and then recession. And back to 2024. Hopefully, you know, while, you know, it is a social history, I hope there is a bit of a joy and
I mean, it is. There's great fun within it, and I must say, the character who never appears, the Jilly Morgan,
couldn't afford it.
We don't need her.
But she is quite the invention, and everybody talks about her a lot, Liam.
Yeah, absolutely. And I suppose she's a fantasy. She is an ideal, and like, while we're looking at possibility and like how joyous and fun that can be, it also, I hope, touches on the problematic nature of male obsession or the male gaze as well as the play progresses. So there is a sinister element, is that fair to say, you know?
Yeah. And I don't want to give too much away in terms of the structure, but we get them at these various points in their lives from 83, as I said, through 96, 2010, 2024. And then we get this flashback to 83, which kind of makes sense of everything that hasn't happened in the meantime. Was that there from the outset, Liam? Did you have that in your mind to bring us back, to give us a little bit of extra context at the end?
Absolutely. Like, you know, I think there has to be hope for these characters by the end. And it's a tiny bit of a call to action saying, like, you know, if you recognise traits of yourself in either Jack or Kate and you can do something about it, maybe you should think about doing that. So hopefully it leaves the story open to your own, you know, what the audience audience might get out of it, and hopefully if you see yourself in it, maybe it's something that, you know, you might want to take care of.
Well, there's a father of a friend of mine who used to always say, you'll only regret what you don't do. There's a bit of that in it.
Absolutely.
It's what you don't do. But certainly you're not regretting what you don't do, Georgina. You had your own show, Free Falling, in Belltable last year. It's returning, and then you're bringing it to Dublin as well?
I believe so, Sean. So we're bringing it back to the Lime Tree in... we actually played in the Belltable last year, and we're taking it to the grander stage, or the bigger stage, of the Lime Tree in September, and then it comes to Dublin in the autumn. So I'm very, very excited about that.
And I guess in terms of Jilly Morgan's birthday party, Liam, you have to see what happens before you decide whether it's going anywhere.
Oh, I'm not taking anything for granted. No. Well, I'm very excited. We've got an absolute stellar team, and the support from Lime Tree Belltable has been absolutely incredible. So, you know, I'm really, really excited, to be honest.
And happy to be writing a big love letter to Limerick.
Yeah, absolutely. And just to say, it takes place in the Belltable Theatre. That's the one on O'Connell Street. Not in the Lime. Yeah.
Right, so it's in the Belltable then, from May the 2nd through until May the 11th.
Absolutely.
Yep.
That's lovely. Liam McCarthy, playwright, Georgina Miller, actor. Thanks so much for being
here. Thanks so much, Sean.
Jilly Morgan's birthday party at the Belltable in Limerick from May the 2nd through until May the 11th. And for tickets and full information, go to limetreebelltable.ie. And that is our lot for this Monday evening here on Arena. Liam Murphy and Niall Fitzmaurice researched. David Phelan was the broadcast coordinator. Cara O'Hare was on sound this evening. And tonight's programme was produced by Sinead Egan.